Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Plot Against America by Philip Roth, narrated by Ron Silver. This book is copyrighted 2004 by Philip Roth. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. When the renowned aviation hero and rabid isolationist Charles A. Lindbergh won a landslide victory over Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940 presidential election, fear invaded every Jewish household in America. Not only had Lindbergh, in a nationwide address, publicly blamed the Jews for selfishly pushing America toward a pointless war with Nazi Germany, but upon taking office as the 33rd President of the United States, he negotiated a cordial understanding with Adolf Hitler. From this point on, American citizens who happened to be Jews had every reason to expect the worst. And now, The Plot Against America.
Houghton Mifflin Company presents The Plot Against America by Philip Roth. Read for you by Ron Silver.
Chapter 1, June 1940 to October 1940. Vote for Lindbergh or vote for war. Fear presides over these memories, a perpetual fear. Of course, no childhood is without its terrors, yet I wonder if I would have been a less frightened boy if Lindbergh hadn't been president, or if I hadn't been the offspring of Jews. When the first shock came in June 1940, the nomination for the presidency of Charles A. Lindbergh, America's international aviation hero, by the Republican convention at Philadelphia, my father was 39, an insurance agent with a grade school education, earning a little under $50 a week, enough for the basic bills to be paid on time, but for little more. My mother, who wanted to go to teacher's college but couldn't because of the expense, who lived at home working as an office secretary after finishing high school, who kept us from feeling poor during the worst of the Depression by budgeting the earnings my father turned over to her each Friday as efficiently as she ran the household, was 36. My brother, Sandy, a seventh grader with a prodigy's talent for drawing, was 12. And I, a third grader, a term ahead of himself, and an embryonic stamp collector, inspired like millions of kids by the country's foremost philatelist, President Roosevelt, was 7. We lived in the second floor flat of a small 2.5 family house on a tree-lined street of frame wooden houses with red brick stoops, each stoop topped with a gable roof and fronted by a tiny yard boxed in with a low-cut hedge. The Wequake neighborhood had been built on farm lots at the undeveloped southwest edge of Newark just after World War I. Some half dozen of the streets named imperially for victorious naval commanders in the Spanish-American War, and the local movie house called, after FDR's fifth cousin and the country's 26th president, the Roosevelt. Our street, Summit Avenue, sat at the crest of the neighborhood hill, an elevation as high as any in a port city that rarely rises 100 feet above the level of the tidal salt marsh to the city's north and east, and the deep bay due east of the airport that bends around the oil tanks of the Bayonne Peninsula and merges there with New York Bay to flow past the Statue of Liberty and into the Atlantic. Looking west from our bedroom's rear window, we could sometimes see inland as far as the dark tree line of the Watchungs, a low-lying mountain range fringed by great estates and affluent, sparsely populated suburbs, the extreme edge of the known world, and about 8 miles from our house. A block to the south was the working-class town of Hillside, whose population was predominantly Gentile. The boundary with Hillside marked the beginning of Union County, another New Jersey entirely. We were a happy family in 1940. My parents were outgoing, hospitable people their friends culled from among my father's associates at the office, and from the women who, along with my mother, had helped to organize the Parent-Teacher Association at newly built Chancellor Avenue School, where my brother and I were pupils. All were Jews. The neighborhood men either were in business for themselves, the owners of the local candy store, grocery store, jewelry store, dress shop, furniture shop, service station, and delicatessen, or the proprietors of tiny industrial job shops over by the Newark Irvington line, or self-employed plumbers, electricians, house painters, and boilermen, or were foot soldier salesmen like my father, out every day in the city streets and in people's houses, peddling their wares on commission. The Jewish doctors and lawyers and the successful merchants who owned the big stores downtown lived in one-family houses on streets branching off the eastern slope of the Chancellor Avenue Hill, closer to grassy, wooded Wequake Park, a landscaped 300 acres whose boating lake, golf course, and harness racing track separated the Wequake section from the industrial plants and shipping terminals lining Route 27 and the Pennsylvania Railroad Viaduct east of that, and the burgeoning airport east of that, and the very edge of America east of that, the depots and docks of Newark Bay, where they unloaded cargo from around the world. At the western end of the neighborhood, the parkless end where we lived, there resided an occasional school teacher or pharmacist, but otherwise, few professionals were among our immediate neighbors, and certainly none of the prosperous entrepreneurial or manufacturing families. The men worked 50, 60, even 70 or more hours a week. The women worked all the time, with little assistance from labor-saving devices, washing laundry, ironing shirts, mending socks, turning collars, sewing on buttons, moth-proofing woolens, polishing furniture, sweeping and washing floors, washing windows, cleaning sinks, tubs, toilets and stoves, vacuuming rugs, nursing the sick, shopping for food, cooking meals, feeding relatives, tidying closets and drawers, overseeing paint jobs and household repairs, arranging for religious observances, paying bills, and keeping the family's books while simultaneously attending to their children's health, clothing, cleanliness, schooling, nutrition, conduct, birthdays, discipline, and morale. A few women labored alongside their husbands in the family-owned stores on the nearby shopping streets, assisted after school and on Saturdays by their older children, who delivered orders and tended stock and did the cleaning up. It was work that identified and distinguished our neighbors from me far more than religion. Nobody in the neighborhood had a beard or dressed in the antiquated old-world style or wore a skull cap, either outdoors or in the houses I routinely floated through with my boyhood friends. The adults were no longer observant in the outward, recognizable ways, if they were seriously observant at all. And aside from older shopkeepers like the tailor and the kosher butcher and the ailing or decrepit grandparents living of necessity with their adult offspring, hardly anyone in the vicinity spoke with an accent. By 1940, Jewish parents and their children at the southwestern corner of New Jersey's largest city talked to one another in an American English that sounded more like the language spoken in Altoona or Binghamton than like the dialects famously spoken across the Hudson by our Jewish counterparts in the five boroughs. Hebrew lettering was stenciled on the butcher shop window and engraved on the lintels of the small neighborhood synagogues, but nowhere else, other than at the cemetery, did one's eye chance to land on the alphabet of the prayer book rather than on the familiar letters of the native tongue employed all the time by practically everyone for every conceivable purpose, high or low. At the newsstand out front of the corner candy store, 10 times more customers bought the racing form than the Yiddish daily, the Forvitz. Israel didn't yet exist. 6 million European Jews hadn't yet ceased to exist, and the local relevance of distant Palestine under British mandate since the 1918 dissolution by the victorious allies of the last far-flung provinces of the defunct Ottoman Empire was a mystery to me. When a stranger who did wear a beard, and who never once was seen hatless, appeared every few months after dark to ask, in broken English, for a contribution toward the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine, I, who wasn't an ignorant child, didn't quite know what he was doing on our landing. My parents would give me or Sandy a couple of coins to drop into his collection box. Largesse, I always thought, dispensed out of kindness so as not to hurt the feelings of a poor old man who, from one year to the next, seemed unable to get it through his head that we'd already had a homeland for three generations. I pledged allegiance to the flag of our homeland every morning at school. I sang of its marvels with my classmates at assembly programs. I eagerly observed its national holidays, and without giving a second thought to my affinity for the 4th of July fireworks or the Thanksgiving turkey or the Decoration Day doubleheader, our homeland was America. Then the Republicans nominated Lindbergh, and everything changed. For nearly a decade, Lindbergh was as great a hero in our neighborhood as he was everywhere else. The completion of his 33-and-a-half-hour nonstop solo flight from Long Island to Paris in the tiny monoplane, the Spirit of St. Louis, even happened to coincide with the day in the spring of 1927 that my mother discovered herself to be pregnant with my older brother. As a consequence, the young aviator, whose daring had thrilled America and the world and whose achievement bespoke a future of unimaginable aeronautical progress, came to occupy a special niche in the gallery of family anecdotes that generate a child's first cohesive mythology. The mystery of pregnancy and the heroism of Lindbergh combined to give a distinction bordering on the divine to my very own mother, for whom nothing less than a global annunciation had accompanied the incarnation of her first child. Sandy would later record this moment with a drawing illustrating the juxtaposition of those two splendid events. In the drawing, completed at the age of 9 and smacking inadvertently of Soviet poster art, Sandy envisioned her miles from our house, amid a joyous crowd on the corner of Broad and Market, a slender young woman of 23, with dark hair and a smile that is all robust delight. She is surprisingly on her own, and wearing her floral patterned kitchen apron at the intersection of the city's two busiest thoroughfares, one hand spread wide across the front of the apron, where the span of her hips is still deceptively girlish, while with the other, she alone in the crowd is pointing skyward to the Spirit of St. Louis, passing visibly above downtown Newark, at precisely the moment she comes to realize that, in a feat no less triumphant for a mortal than Lindbergh's, she has conceived Sanford Roth. Sandy was 4, and I, Philip, wasn't yet born when in March 1932, Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's own first child, a boy, whose arrival 20 months earlier had been an occasion for national rejoicing, was kidnapped from his family's secluded new house in rural Hopewell, New Jersey. Some 10 weeks later, the decomposing body of the baby was discovered by chance in woods a few miles away. The baby had been either murdered or killed accidentally, after being snatched from his crib and, in the dark, still in bedclothes, carried out a window of the second-story nursery and down a makeshift ladder to the ground while the nurse and the mother were occupied in their ordinary evening activities in another part of the house. By the time the kidnapping and murder trial in Flemington, New Jersey, concluded in February 1935 with the conviction of Bruno Hauptmann, a German ex-con of 35 living in the Bronx with his German wife, the boldness of the world's first transatlantic solo pilot had been permeated with a pathos that transformed him into a martyred titan comparable to Lincoln. Following the trial, the Lindberghs left America, hoping through a temporary expatriation to protect a new Lindbergh infant from harm and to recover some measure of the privacy they coveted. The family moved to a small village in England, and from there, as a private citizen, Lindbergh began taking the trips to Nazi Germany that would transform him into a villain for most American Jews. In the course of 5 visits, during which he was able to familiarize himself at first hand with the magnitude of the German war machine, he was ostentatiously entertained by Air Marshal Goering. He was ceremoniously decorated in the name of the Führer, and he expressed quite openly his high regard for Hitler, calling Germany the world's most interesting nation, and its leader, a great man. And all this interest and admiration after Hitler's 1935 racial laws had denied Germany's Jews their civil, social, and property rights, nullified their citizenship, and forbidden intermarriage with Aryans. By the time I began school in 1938, Lindbergh's was a name that provoked the same sort of indignation in our house as did the weekly Sunday radio broadcasts of Father Coughlin, the Detroit area priest who edited a right-wing weekly called Social Justice, and whose anti-Semitic virulence aroused the passions of a sizable audience during the country's hard times. It was in November 1938, the darkest, most ominous year for the Jews of Europe in 18 centuries, that the worst pogrom in modern history, Kristallnacht, was instigated by the Nazis all across Germany. Synagogues incinerated, the residences and businesses of Jews destroyed, and throughout a night presaging the monstrous future. Jews, by the thousands, forcibly taken from their homes and transported to concentration camps. When it was suggested to Lindbergh that in response to this unprecedented savagery, perpetrated by a state on its own native-born, he might consider returning the gold cross, decorated with four swastikas, bestowed on him in behalf of the Führer by Air Marshal Göring, he declined, on the grounds that for him to publicly surrender the service medal of the German Eagle would constitute an unnecessary insult to the Nazi leadership. Lindbergh was the first famous living American whom I learned to hate, just as President Roosevelt was the first famous living American whom I was taught to love. And so, his nomination by the Republicans to run against Roosevelt in 1940 assaulted, as nothing ever had before, that huge endowment of personal security that I had taken for granted as an American child, of American parents in an American school, in an American city, in an America at peace with the world. The only comparable threat had come some 13 months earlier when, on the basis of consistently high sales through the worst of the Depression, as an agent with the Newark office of Metropolitan Life, my father had been offered a promotion to assistant manager in charge of agents at the company's office 6 miles west of our house in Union, a town whose only distinction I knew of was a drive-in theater where movies were shown even when it rained, and where the company expected my father and his family to live if he took the job. As an assistant manager, my father could soon be making $75 a week, and over the coming years as much as $100 a week, a fortune in 1939 to people with our expectations. And since there were one-family houses selling in Union for a depression low of a few thousand dollars, he would be able to realize an ambition he had nurtured growing up penniless in a Newark tenement flat, to become an American homeowner. Pride of ownership was a favorite phrase of my father's, embodying an idea real as bread to a man of his background, one having to do not with social competitiveness or conspicuous consumption, but with his standing as a manly provider. The single drawback was that because Union, like Hillside, was a Gentile working-class town, my father would most likely be the only Jew in an office of some 35 people, my mother the only Jewish woman on our street, and Sandy and I the only Jewish kids in our school. On the Saturday after my father was offered the promotion, a promotion that, above all, would answer a Depression family's yearning for a tiny margin of financial security, the four of us headed off after lunch to look around Union. But once we were there and driving up and down the residential streets, peering out at the two-story houses, not quite identical, but each, nonetheless, with a screened front porch and a mown lawn and a piece of shrubbery, and a cinder drive leading to a one-car garage, very modest houses, but still roomier than our two-bedroom flat, and looking a lot like the little white houses in the movies about small-town salt-of-the-earth America. Once we were there, our innocent buoyancy about the family ascent into the homeowning class was supplanted, predictably enough, by our anxieties about the scope of Christian charity. My ordinarily energetic mother responded to my father's, "What do you think, Bess?" with enthusiasm that even a child understood to be feigned. And young as I was, I was able to surmise why, because she was thinking, ours will be the house where the Jews live. It'll be Elizabeth all over again. Elizabeth, New Jersey, when my mother was being raised there in a flat over her father's grocery store, was an industrial port quarter the size of Newark, dominated by the Irish working class and their politicians and the tightly knit parish life that revolved around the town's many churches. And though I never heard her complain of having been pointedly ill-treated in Elizabeth as a girl, it was not until she married and moved to Newark's new Jewish neighborhood that she discovered the confidence that led her to become first a PTA grade mother, then a PTA vice president in charge of establishing a kindergarten mother's club, and finally the PTA president, who, after attending a conference in Trenton on infantile paralysis, proposed an annual March of Dimes dance on January 30th, President Roosevelt's birthday, that was accepted by most Newark schools. In the spring of 1939, she was in her second successful year as a leader with progressive ideas, already supporting a young social studies teacher keen on bringing visual education into chancellor's classrooms, and now she couldn't help but envision herself bereft of all that had been achieved by her becoming a wife and a mother on Summit Avenue. Should we have the good fortune to buy and move into a house on any of the Union Streets we were seeing at their springtime best, not only would her status slip back to what it had been when she was growing up, the daughter of a Jewish immigrant grocer and Irish Catholic Elizabeth, but worse than that, Sandy and I would be obliged to relive her own circumscribed youth as a neighborhood outsider. Despite my mother's mood, my father did everything he could to keep up our spirits, remarking on how clean and well-kept everything looked, reminding Sandy and me that living in one of these houses, the two of us would no longer have to share a small bedroom and a single closet, and explaining the benefits to be derived from paying off a mortgage rather than paying rent. A lesson in elementary economics that abruptly ended when it was necessary for him to stop the car at a red light beside a park-like drinking establishment dominating one corner of the intersection. There were green picnic tables set out beneath the shade trees filled with foliage, and on this sunny weekend afternoon, there were waiters in braided white coats moving swiftly about, balancing trays laden with bottles and pitchers and plates, and men of every age gathered at each of the tables, smoking cigarettes and pipes and cigars, and drinking deeply from tall beakers and earthenware mugs. There was music, too, an accordion being played by a stout little man in short pants and high socks who wore a hat ornamented with a long feather. "The sons of bitches," my father said. "Fascist bastards." And then the light changed, and we drove on in silence to look at the office building where he was about to get his chance to earn more than $50 a week. It was my brother who, when we went to bed that night, explained why my father had lost control and cursed aloud in front of his children. The homey acre of open-air merriment smack in the middle of town was called a beer garden. The beer garden had something to do with the German-American Bund. The German-American Bund had something to do with Hitler. And Hitler, as I hadn't to be told, had everything to do with persecuting Jews. The intoxicant of anti-Semitism. That's what I came to imagine them all so cheerfully drinking in their beer garden that day. Like all the Nazis everywhere, downing pint after pint of anti-Semitism as though imbibing the universal remedy. My father had to take off a morning of work to go over to the home office in New York, to the tall building whose uppermost tower was crowned with the beacon his company proudly designated the light that never fails, and informed the superintendent of agencies that he couldn't accept the promotion he longed for. "It's my fault," announced my mother, as soon as he began to recount at the dinner table what had transpired there on the 18th floor of 1 Madison Avenue. "It's nobody's fault," my father said. "I explained before I left what I was going to tell him, and I went over and I told him, and that's it. We're not moving to Union, boys. We're staying right here." "What did he do?" my mother asked. "He heard me out." "And then?" she asked. "He stood up and he shook my hand." "He didn't say anything?" "He said, 'Good luck, Roth.'" "He was angry with you." "Hatcher is a gentleman of the old school. Big 6-foot guy, looks like a movie star, 60 years old and fit as a fiddle.
These are the people who run things best. They don't waste their time getting angry at someone like me. So now what? She asked, implying that whatever happened as a result of his meeting with Hatcher was not going to be good and could be dire. And I thought I understood why. Apply yourself and you can do it. That was the axiom in which we had been schooled by both parents. At the dinner table, my father would reiterate to his young sons time and again, if anybody asks, can you do this job? Can you handle it? You tell them, absolutely. By the time they find out that you can't, you'll already have learned and the job will be yours. And who knows, it just might turn out to be the opportunity of a lifetime. Yet, over in New York, he had done nothing like that. What did the boss say? She asked him. The boss was how the four of us referred to the manager of my father's Newark office, Sam Peterfreund. In those days of unadvertised quotas to keep Jewish admissions to a minimum in colleges and professional schools, and of unchallenged discrimination that denied Jews significant promotions in the big corporations, and of rigid restrictions against Jewish membership in thousands of social organizations and communal institutions, Peterfreund was one of the first of the small handful of Jews ever to achieve a managerial position with Metropolitan Life. He's the one who put you up for it, my mother said. How must he feel? Know what he said to me when I got back? Know what he told me about the union office? It's full of drunks. Famous for drunks. Beforehand, he didn't want to influence my decision. He didn't want to stand in my way if this was what I wanted. Famous for agents who work 2 hours in the morning and spend the rest of their time in the tavern or worse. And I was supposed to go there, the new Jew. The big new sheeny boss the Goyim are all dying to work for, and I was supposed to go there and pick them up off the barroom floor. I was supposed to go in there and remind them of their obligation to their wives and their children. Oh, how they would have loved me, boys, for doing them the favor. You can imagine what they would have called me behind my back now. I'm better off where I am. We're all better off. But can the company fire you for turning them down? Honey, I did what I did. That's the end of it. But she didn't believe what he told her the boss had said. She believed that he was making up what the boss had said to get her to stop blaming herself for having refused to move her children to a Gentile town that was a haven for the German-American Bund, and by having done so, denying him the opportunity of his lifetime. The Lindberghs returned to resume their family life in America in April 1939. Only months later, in September, having already annexed Austria and overrun Czechoslovakia, Hitler invaded and conquered Poland, and France and Great Britain responded by declaring war on Germany. Lindbergh had by then been activated as a colonel in the Army Air Corps, and he now began traveling around the country for the U.S. government, lobbying for the development of American aviation and for expanding and modernizing the air wing of the armed forces. When Hitler quickly occupied Denmark, Norway, Holland, and Belgium, and all but defeated France, and the second great European war of the century was well underway, the Air Corps colonel made himself the idol of the isolationists and the enemy of FDR by adding to his mission the goal of preventing America from being drawn into the war or in any way aiding the British or the French. There was already a strong animosity between him and Roosevelt. But now that he was declaring openly at large public meetings and on network radio and in popular magazines that the president was misleading the country with promises of peace while secretly agitating and planning for our entry into the armed struggle, some in the Republican Party began to talk up Lindbergh as the man with the magic to beat the warmonger in the White House out of a third term. The more pressure Roosevelt put on Congress to repeal the arms embargo and loosened the strictures on the country's neutrality so as to prevent the British from being defeated, the more forthright Lindbergh became until finally he made the famous radio speech before a hall full of cheering supporters in Des Moines that named among those, and I quote, most powerful and effective in pushing the United States toward involvement in the war, end quote, a group constituting less than 3% of the population, and referred to alternately as the Jewish people and the Jewish race. No person of honesty and vision, Lindbergh said, can look on their pro-war policy here today without seeing the dangers involved in such a policy, both for us and for them. And then, with remarkable candor, he added, "A few far-sighted Jewish people realize this and stand opposed to intervention, but the majority still do not. We cannot blame them for looking out for what they believe to be their own interests, but we must also look out for ours. We cannot allow the natural passions and prejudices of other peoples to lead our country to destruction." The next day, the very accusations that had elicited roars of approval from Lindbergh's Iowa audience were vigorously denounced by liberal journalists, by Roosevelt's press secretary, by Jewish agencies and organizations, even from within the Republican Party, by New York's Governor Dewey and the Wall Street utilities lawyer Wendell Willkie, both potential presidential nominees. So severe was the criticism from Democratic cabinet members like Interior Secretary Harold Dickies that Lindbergh resigned his reserve commission as an Army colonel rather than serve under FDR as his commander-in-chief. But the America First Committee, the broadest-based organization leading the battle against intervention, continued to support him, and he remained the most popular proselytizer of its argument for neutrality. For many America Firsters, there was no debating, even with the facts, Lindbergh's contention that the Jews, and I quote again, "greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government." When Lindbergh wrote proudly of our inheritance of European blood, when he warned against dilution by foreign races and the infiltration of inferior blood, all phrases that turn up in diary entries from those years, he was recording personal convictions shared by a sizable portion of America First's rank-and-file membership, as well as by a rabid constituency even more extensive than a Jew like my father with his bitter hatred of anti-Semitism, or like my mother with a deeply ingrained mistrust of Christians, could ever imagine to be flourishing all across America. The 1940 Republican Convention. My brother and I went to sleep that night, Thursday, June 27th, while the radio was on in the living room and our father, our mother, and our older cousin Alvin sat listening together to the live coverage from Philadelphia. After six ballots, the Republicans still hadn't selected a candidate. Lindbergh's name was yet to be uttered by a single delegate. And because of an engineering conclave at a Midwestern factory where he'd been advising on the design of a new fighter plane, he wasn't present or expected to be. When Sandy and I went to bed, the convention remained divided among Dewey, Willkie, and two powerful Republican senators, Vandenberg of Michigan and Taft of Ohio, and it didn't look as though a backroom deal was about to be brokered anytime soon by party bigwigs, like former President Hoover, who'd been ousted from office by FDR's overwhelming 1932 victory, or by Governor Alf Landon, whom FDR had defeated even more ignominiously 4 years later in the biggest landslide in history. Because it was the first muggy evening of the summer, the windows were open in every room, and Sandy and I couldn't help but continue to follow from bed the proceedings being aired over our own living room radio and the radio playing in the flat downstairs and, since an alleyway only barely wide enough for a single car separated one house from the next, the radios of our neighbors to either side and across the way. As this was long before window air conditioners bested the noises of a neighborhood's tropical nights, the broadcast blanketed the block from Keir to Chancellor, a block on which not a single Republican lived in any of the 30-odd, two-and-a-half family houses or in the small new apartment building at the Chancellor Avenue corner. On streets like ours, the Jews voted straight Democratic for as long as FDR was at the top of the ticket. But we were two kids and fell asleep despite everything and probably wouldn't have awakened till morning had not Lindbergh, with the Republicans deadlocked on the 20th ballot, made his unanticipated entrance onto the convention floor at 3:18 a.m. The lean, tall, handsome hero, a lithe, athletic-looking man not yet 40 years old, arrived in his flying attire, having landed his own plane at the Philadelphia airport only minutes earlier, and at the sight of him, a surge of redemptive excitement brought the wilted conventioneers up onto their feet to cry, Lindy, 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 for 30 glorious minutes, and without interruption from the chair. Behind the successful execution of this spontaneous, pseudo-religious drama lay the machinations of Senator Gerald P. Nye of North Dakota, a right-wing isolationist who quickly placed in nomination the name of Charles A. Lindbergh of Little Falls, Minnesota, whereupon two of the most reactionary members of Congress, Senator McCarran of Nevada and Congressman Mundt of South Dakota, seconded the nomination, and at precisely 4 a.m. on Friday, June 28th, the Republican Party, by acclamation, chose as its candidate the bigot who had denounced Jews over the airwaves to a national audience as other peoples, employing their enormous influence to lead our country to destruction. Rather than truthfully acknowledging us to be a small minority of citizens vastly outnumbered by their Christian countrymen, by and large obstructed by religious prejudice from attaining public power, and surely no less loyal to the principles of American democracy than an admirer of Adolf Hitler. No, was the word that awakened us. No, being shouted in a man's loud voice from every house on the block. It can't be. No, not for President of the United States. Within seconds, my brother and I were once more at the radio with the rest of the family, and nobody bothered telling us to go back to bed. Hot as it was, my decorous mother had pulled a robe over her thin nightdress. She too had been asleep and roused by the noise, and she sat now on the sofa beside my father, her fingers over her mouth, as though she were trying to keep from being sick. Meanwhile, my cousin Alvin, able no longer to remain in his seat, set about pacing a room 18 by 12 with a force in his gait befitting an avenger out searching the city to dispose of his nemesis. The anger that night was the real roaring forge, the furnace that takes you and twists you like steel. And it didn't subside, not while Lindbergh stood silently at the Philadelphia rostrum and heard himself being cheered once again as the nation's savior, nor when he gave the speech, accepting his party's nomination and with it the mandate to keep America out of the European war. We all waited in terror to hear him repeat to the convention his malicious vilification of the Jews. But that he didn't made no difference to the mood that carried every last family on the block out into the street at nearly 5 a.m. Entire families known to me previously only fully dressed in daytime clothing were wearing pajamas and nightdresses under their bathrobes and milling around in their slippers at dawn as if driven from their homes by an earthquake. But what shocked a child most was the anger. The anger of men whom I knew as light-hearted kibitzes or silent, dutiful breadwinners who all day long unclogged drain pipes or service furnaces or sold apples by the pound, and then in the evening looked at the paper and listened to the radio and fell asleep in the living room chair, plain people who happened to be Jews now storming about the street and cursing with no concern for propriety, abruptly thrust back into the miserable struggle from which they had believed their families extricated by the providential migration of the generation before. I would have imagined Lindbergh's not mentioning the Jews in his acceptance speech to be a promising omen, an indication that he had been chastened by the outcry that had caused him to relinquish his army commission, or that he had changed his mind since the Des Moines speech, or that he had already forgotten about us, or that secretly he knew full well that we were committed irrevocably to America, that though Ireland still mattered to the Irish and Poland to the Poles and Italy to the Italians, we retained no allegiance, sentimental or otherwise, to those old world countries that we had never been welcome in and that we had no intention of ever returning to. If I could have thought through the meaning of the moment in so many words, this is probably what I would have been thinking. But the men out on the street thought differently. Lindbergh's not mentioning the Jews was to them a trick and no more. the initiation of a campaign of deceit intended both to shut us up and to catch us off guard. Hitler in America, the neighbors cried. Fascism in America. Stormtroopers in America. After their having gone without sleep all night long, there was nothing that these bewildered elders of ours didn't think, and nothing that they didn't say aloud within our hearing before they started to drift back to their houses, where all the radios still blared away. The men to shave and dress and grab a cup of coffee before heading for work, and the women to get their children clothed and fed and ready for the day. Roosevelt raised everyone's spirits by his robust response on hearing that his opponent was to be Lindbergh rather than a senator of the stature of Taft, or a former prosecutor as aggressive as Dewey, or a big-time lawyer as smooth and handsome as Wilkie. When awakened at 4 a.m. to be told the news, he was said to have predicted from his White House bed, "By the time this is over, the young man will be sorry not only that he entered politics, but that he ever learned to fly." Whereupon he fell immediately back into a sound sleep. Or so went the story that brought us such solace the next day. Out on the street, when all anyone could think about was the menace posed to our safety by this transparently unjust affront, people had oddly forgotten about FDR and the bulwark he was against oppression. The sheer surprise of the Lindbergh nomination had activated an atavistic sense of being undefended that had more to do with Kishinev and the pogroms of 1903 than with New Jersey 37 years later, and as a consequence, they had forgotten about Roosevelt's appointment to the Supreme Court of Felix Frankfurter and his selection as Treasury Secretary of Henry Morgenthau, and about the close presidential advisor, financier Bernard Baruch, and about Mrs. Roosevelt and Ickes and Vice President Wallace, all three of whom, like the president, were known to be friends of the Jews. There was Roosevelt, there was the U.S. Constitution, there was the Bill of Rights, and there were the papers, America's Free Press. Even the Republican Newark Evening News published an editorial reminding readers of the Des Moines speech and openly challenging the wisdom of Lindbergh's nomination. And PM, the new left-wing New York tabloid that cost a nickel and that my father had begun bringing home with him after work along with the Newark News, and whose slogan read, "PM is against people who push other people around," leveled its assault on the Republicans in a lengthy editorial, as well as in news stories and columns on virtually every one of its 32 pages, including anti-Lindbergh columns in the sports section by Tom Meaney and Joe Comiskey. On the front page, the paper featured a large photo of Lindbergh's Nazi medal, and in its Daily Picture magazine, where it claimed to run photographs that other papers suppressed, controversial photos of lynch mobs and chain gangs, of strikebreakers wielding clubs, of inhuman conditions in America's penitentiaries, there was page after page showing the Republican candidate touring Nazi Germany in 1938, culminating in the full-page picture of him, the notorious medal around his neck, shaking the hand of Hermann Göring, the Nazi leader second only to Hitler. On Sunday night, we waited through the lineup of comedy programs for Walter Winchell to come on at 9. And when he did, and proceeded to say what we had hoped he would say, just as contemptuously as we wanted him to say it, applause erupted from across the alleyway, as though the famous newsman weren't walled off in a radio studio on the far side of the great divide that was the Hudson, but were here among us and fighting mad, his tie pulled down, his collar unbuttoned, his gray fedora angled back on his head, lambasting Lindbergh from a microphone atop the oilcloth covering on the kitchen table of our next-door neighbor. It was the last night of June, 1940. After a warm day, it had grown cool enough to sit comfortably indoors without perspiring. But when Winchell signed off at 9:15, our parents were moved to go outside for the four of us to take in the lovely evening together. We were just going to walk to the corner and back, after which my brother and I would go to sleep. But it was nearly midnight before we got to bed, and by then sleep was out of the question for kids so overcome by their parents' excitement. Because Winchell's fearless bellicosity had propelled all of our neighbors outdoors as well, What had begun for us as a cheerful little evening stroll ended as an impromptu block party for everyone. The men dragged beach chairs from the garages and unfolded them at the foot of the alleyways. The women carried pitchers of lemonade from the houses. The youngest of the children ran wildly from stoop to stoop, and the older ones sat laughing and talking off by themselves. And all because war had been declared on Lindbergh by America's best-known Jew after Albert Einstein. It was Winchell, after all, whose column had famously ushered in the three dots separating and somehow magically validating each hot news item, ever so tenuously grounded in fact. And it was Winchell who'd more or less originated the idea of firing into the face of the credulous masses buckshot pellets of insinuating gossip, ruining reputations, compromising celebrities, bestowing fame, making and breaking showbiz careers. It was his column alone that was syndicated in hundreds of papers all across the country, and his Sunday night quarter of an hour that was the country's most popular news program. The rapid-fire Winchell delivery and the pugnacious Winchell cynicism lending every scoop the sensational air of an exposé. We admired him as a fearless outsider and a cunning insider, a pal of J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, as well as a neighbor of the mobster Frank Costello, and a confidant of Roosevelt's inner circle, even a sometimes guest invited to the White House to amuse the president over a drink. The in-the-know street fighter and hard-boiled man about town whom his enemies feared and who was on our side. Manhattan-born Walter Winchell, a.k.a. Von Schell, had transformed himself from a New York vaudeville dancer into a callow Broadway columnist earning big money by embodying the passions of the cheesiest of the new subliterate dailies. Though ever since the rise of Hitler, and long before anyone else in the press had the foresight or the wrath to take them on, fascists and anti-Semites had become his number one enemy. He'd already labeled as Razzies the German-American Bund and hounded its leader Fritz Kuhn over the air and in print as a secret foreign agent. And now, after FDR's joke, the Newark News editorial, and the thoroughgoing denunciation by PM, Walter Winchell had only to disclose Lindbergh's pro-Nazi philosophy to his 30 million Sunday evening listeners and to call Lindbergh's presidential candidacy the greatest threat ever to American democracy for all the Jewish families on block-long Little Summit Avenue to resemble once again Americans enjoying the vitality and high spirits of a secure, free, protected citizenry instead of casting themselves about outdoors in their nightclothes like inmates escaped from a lunatic asylum. My brother was known throughout the neighborhood for being able to draw anything. A bike, a tree, a dog, a chair, a cartoon character like Little Abner. Though his interest of late was in real faces. Kids were always gathering around to watch him wherever he would park himself after school with his large spiral pad and his mechanical pencil and begin to sketch the people nearby. Inevitably, the onlookers would start to shout, "Draw him! Draw her! Draw me!" And Sandy would take up the exhortation, if only to stop them from screaming in his ear. All the while, his hand was working away. He'd look up, down, and behold, there lived so-and-so on a sheet of paper. "What's the trick?" they all asked him. "How'd you do it?" As if tracing, as if outright magic, might have played some part in the feat. Sandy's answer to all this pestering was a shrug or a smile. The trick to doing it was his being the quiet, serious, unostentatious boy that he was, compelling attention wherever he went by turning out the likenesses people requested had seemingly no effect on the impersonal element at the core of his strength, the inborn modesty that was his toughness and that he later sidestepped at his peril. At home, he was no longer copying illustrations from Collier's or photos from Look, but studying from an art manual on the figure. He'd won the book in an Arbor Day poster contest for school kids that had coincided with a citywide tree planting program administered by the Department of Parks and Public Property. There had even been a ceremony where he'd shaken the hand of a Mr. Banwart, who was superintendent of the Bureau of Shade Trees. The design of his winning poster was based on a red 2-cent stamp in my collection commemorating the 60th anniversary of Arbor Day. The stamp seemed to me especially beautiful because visible within each of its narrow vertical white borders was a slender tree whose branches arched at the top to meet and form an arbor. And until the stamp became mine and I was able to examine through my magnifying glass its distinguishing marks, the meaning of arbor had been swallowed up in the familiar name of the holiday. The small magnifying glass, along with an album for 2,500 stamps, a stamp tweezers, a perforation gauge, gummed stamp hinges, and a black rubber dish called a watermark detector, had been a gift from my parents for my 7th birthday. For an additional 10 cents, they also bought me a small book of 90-odd pages called The Stamp Collector's Handbook, where, under How to Start a Stamp Collection, I'd read with fascination this sentence. Old business files or private correspondence often contain stamps of discontinued issues which are of great value. So if you have any friends living in old houses who have accumulated material of this sort in their attics, try to obtain their old stamped envelopes and wrappers. We didn't have an attic. None of our friends living in flats and apartments had attics. But there had been attics just beneath the roofs of the one-family houses in Union. From my seat in the back of the car, I could see little attic windows at either end of each of the houses as we'd driven around the town on that terrible Saturday the year before. And so all I could think of when we got home in the afternoon were the old stamped envelopes and the embossed stamps on the prepaid newspaper wrappers secreted up in those attics, and how I would now have no chance to obtain them because I was a Jew. The appeal of the Arbor Day commemorative stamp was greatly enhanced by its representing a human activity as opposed to a famous person's portrait or a picture of an important place, an activity, what's more, being performed by children. In the center of the stamp, a boy and a girl looking to be about 10 or 11 are planting a young tree. The boy digging with a spade while the girl, supporting the trunk of the tree with one hand, holds it steadily in place over the hole. In Sandy's poster, the boy and the girl are repositioned and stand on opposite sides of the tree. The boy is pictured as right-handed rather than left-handed. He wears long pants instead of knickers, and one of his feet is atop the blade, pressing it into the ground. There is also a third child in Sandy's poster, a boy about my age, who is now the one wearing the knickers. He stands back and to the side of the sapling and holds ready a watering can, as I held one when I modeled for Sandy, clad in my best school knickers and high socks. Adding this child was my mother's idea, to help distinguish Sandy's artwork from that of the Arbor Day stamp and protect him from the charge of copying, but also to provide the poster with a social content that implied a theme by no means common in 1940, not in poster art or anywhere else either, and that for reasons of taste might even have proved unacceptable to the judges. The third child planting the tree was a Negro, and what encouraged my mother to suggest including him, aside from the desire to instill in her children the civic virtue of tolerance, was another stamp of mine, a brand new 10-cent issue in the Educators group. 5 stamps that I'd purchased at the post office for a total of 21 cents and paid for over the month of March out of my weekly allowance of a nickel. Above the central portrait, each stamp featured a picture of a lamp that the U.S. Post Office Department identified as the Lamp of Knowledge, but that I thought of as Aladdin's lamp because of the boy in the Arabian Nights with the magic lamp and the ring and the 2 genies who give him whatever he asks for. What I would have asked for from a genie were the most coveted of all American stamps. First, the celebrated 1918 24-cent airmail, a stamp said to be worth $3,400, where the plane pictured at the center, the Army's Flying Jenny, is inverted. And after that, the 3 famous stamps in the Pan American Exposition issue of 1901 that had also been mistakenly printed with inverted centers and were worth over $1,000 apiece. On the green 1-cent stamp in the Educators group, just above the picture of the Lamp of Knowledge, was Horace Mann, On the red 2-cent, Mark Hopkins. On the purple 3-cent, Charles W. Eliot. On the blue 4-cent, Francis E. Willard. On the brown 10-cent was Booker T. Washington, the first Negro to appear on an American stamp. I remember that after placing the Booker T. Washington in my album and showing my mother how it completed the set of five, I had asked her, "Do you think there'll ever be a Jew on a stamp?" And she replied, "Probably. Someday, yes. I hope so, anyway." In fact, another 26 years had to pass, and it took Einstein to do it. Sandy saved his weekly allowance of 25 cents, and what change he earned shoveling snow and raking leaves and washing the family car, until he had enough to bicycle to the stationery store on Clinton Avenue that carried art supplies, and over a period of months, to buy a charcoal pencil, then sandpaper blocks to sharpen the pencil, then charcoal paper, then the little tubular metal contraption he blew into to apply the fine fixative mist that prevented the charcoal from smudging. He had big bulldog clips, a Masonite board, yellow Ticonderoga pencils, erasers, sketch pads, drawing paper, equipment that he stored in a grocery carton at the bottom of our bedroom closet and that my mother, when she was cleaning, wasn't permitted to disturb. His energetic meticulousness passed on from our mother, and his breathtaking perseverance passed on from our father, served only to magnify my awe of an older brother who everyone agreed was intended for great things. While most boys his age didn't look as though they were intended even to eat at a table with another human being. I was then the good child, obedient both at home and at school. The willfulness largely inactive, and the attack set to go off at a later date, as yet altogether too young to know the potential of a rage of one's own, and nowhere was I less intransigent than with him. For his 12th birthday, Sandy had gotten a large, flat, black portfolio made of hard cardboard that folded along a sewn seam and was secured at the top edge with two attached lengths of ribbon that he tied in a bow in order to fasten the leaves. The portfolio measured about 2 feet by 1.5 feet, too big to fit into the drawers of our bedroom dresser or to be stacked upright against the wall in the crowded bedroom closet he and I shared. He was allowed to store it, along with his spiral sketch pads, laid out flat beneath his bed, and in it, he saved the drawings he considered his best, beginning with his compositional masterwork of 1936, the ambitious picture of our mother pointing overhead at the Paris-bound spirit of St. Louis. Sandy had several large portraits of the heroic aviator in both pencil and charcoal stowed away in his portfolio. They were part of a series he was assembling of prominent Americans that concentrated primarily on those living eminences most revered by our parents, such as President and Mrs. Roosevelt, New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis, and the novelist Pearl Buck, who won the Nobel Prize in 1938 and whose picture he copied from the jacket of one of her bestsellers. A number of drawings in the portfolio were of family members, and of those, at least half were of our sole surviving grandparent, our paternal grandmother, who, on the Sundays when my Uncle Monty brought her around to visit, would sometimes serve Sandy as a model. Under the sway of the word venerable, he drew every wrinkle he could find in her face and every gnarl in her arthritic fingers while, as dutifully as she scrubbed floors on her knees all her life and cooked for family of nine on a coal stove, tiny, sturdy grandma sat in the kitchen and posed. We were alone together in the house only a few days after the Winchell broadcast when Sandy removed the portfolio from under his bed and carried it into the dining room. There, he opened it out on the table, reserved for entertaining the boss and celebrating special family occasions, and carefully lifted the Lindbergh portraits from the tracing paper that protected each drawing and lined them up on the tabletop. In the first, Lindbergh was wearing his leather flying cap with the loose straps dangling over each ear. In the second, the cap was partially hidden beneath large heavy goggles pushed up from his eyes and onto his forehead. In the third, he was bareheaded, nothing to mark him as an aviator other than the uncompromising gaze out to the distant horizon. To gauge the value of this man, as Sandy had rendered him, wasn't difficult. A virile hero. A courageous adventurer. A natural person of gigantic strength and rectitude combined with a powerful blandness. Anything but a frightening villain or a menace to mankind. He's going to be president, Sandy told me. Alvin says Lindbergh's going to win. He so confused and frightened me that I pretended he was making a joke and laughed. Alvin's going to go to Canada and join the Canadian Army, he said. He's going to fight for the British against Hitler. But nobody can beat Roosevelt, I said. Lindbergh's going to. America's going to go fascist. Then we just stood there, together under the intimidating spell of the three portraits. Never before had being seven felt like such a serious deficiency. Don't tell anybody I've got these, he said. But Mom and Dad saw them already, I said. They've seen them all. Everybody has. I told them I tore them up. There was nobody more truthful than my brother. He wasn't quiet because he was secretive and deceitful, but because he never bothered to behave badly and so had nothing to hide. But now something external had transformed the meaning of these drawings, making them into what they were not, and so he told our parents that he'd destroyed them, making himself into what he was not. Suppose they find them, I said. How will they do that, he asked. I don't know. Right, he said. You don't. Just keep your little trap shut and nobody will find anything. I did as he told me for many reasons. One being that the third oldest U.S. postage stamp I owned, which I couldn't possibly tear up and throw away, was a 10-cent airmail issued in 1927 to commemorate Lindbergh's transatlantic flight. It was a blue stamp, about twice as long as it was high, whose central design, a picture of the Spirit of St. Louis flying eastward over the ocean, had provided Sandy with the model for the plane in the drawing celebrating his conception. Adjacent to the white border at the left of the stamp is the coastline of North America with the words New York jutting out into the Atlantic, and adjacent to the border at the right, the coastline of Ireland, Great Britain, and France, with the word Paris at the end of a dotted arc that charts the flight path between the two cities. At the top of the stamp, directly beneath the white letters that boldly spell out United States Postage, are the words Lindbergh Airmail, in slightly smaller type, but large enough, certainly, to be read by a 7-year-old with perfect vision. The stamp was already valued at 20 cents by Scott's standard postage stamp catalog, and what I immediately realized was that its worth would only continue increasing, and so rapidly as to become my single most valuable possession, if Alvin was right and the worst happened. On the sidewalk during the long vacation months, we played a new game called I Declare War, using a cheap rubber ball and a piece of chalk. With the chalk, you drew a circle some 5 or 6 feet in diameter, partitioned it into as many pie-like segments as there were players, and chalked into each the name of one of various foreign countries that had been in the news throughout the year. Next, each player picked his country and stood straddling the edge of the circle, 1 foot inside and 1 out, so that when the time came, he could flee in a hurry. Meanwhile, a designated player, holding the ball aloft in his hand, announced slowly in an ominous cadence, I declare war on... There was a suspenseful pause, and then the kid declaring war would slam the ball down in the same instant, shouting, Germany, or Japan, or Holland, or Italy, or Belgium, or England, or China, sometimes even shouting America, and everybody would take off except the one on whom the surprise attack had been launched. His job was to catch the ball on the bounce as quickly as he could and call stop. Everybody now allied against him would have to freeze in place, and the victim country would begin the counterattack, trying to eliminate one aggressive country at a time by walloping each as hard as he could with the ball, beginning by throwing at those closest to him and advancing his position with each murderous thwack. We played this game incessantly, until it rained and temporarily the names of the countries were washed away. People had to either step on them or step over them when they made their way down the street. In our neighborhood, there was no other graffiti to speak of in those days, just this, the remnants of the hieroglyphics of our simple street games. Harmless enough, and yet it drove some of the mothers crazy who had to hear us at it for hours on end through their open windows. Can't you kids do something else? Can't you find another game to play? But we couldn't. Declaring war was all we thought about, too. On July 18, 1940, the Democratic Convention meeting in Chicago overwhelmingly nominated FDR for a third term on the first ballot. We listened on the radio to his acceptance speech, delivered with the confidently intoned upper-class enunciation that, for close to 8 years now, had inspired millions of ordinary families like ours to remain hopeful in the midst of hardship. There was something about the inherent decorum of the delivery that, alien though it was, not only calmed our anxiety, but bestowed on our family historical significance, authoritatively merging our lives with his, as well as with that of the entire nation when he addressed us in our living room as his fellow citizens. That Americans could choose Lindbergh, that Americans could choose anybody, rather than the two-term president whose voice alone conveyed mastery over the tumult of human affairs, well, that was unthinkable. And certainly so for a little American like me, who'd never known a presidential voice other than his. Some 6 weeks later, on the Saturday before Labor Day, Lindbergh surprised the country by failing to appear at the Detroit Labor Day parade, where he'd been scheduled to launch his campaign with a motorcade through the working-class heartland of isolationist America and the anti-Semitic stronghold of Father Coughlin and Henry Ford, and by arriving unannounced instead at the Long Island airfield from which a spectacular transatlantic flight had begun 13 years before. The Spirit of St. Louis had been secretly trucked in under a tarp and stored overnight in a remote hangar, though by the time Lindbergh taxied the plane onto the field the next morning, every wire service in America and every radio station and newspaper in New York had a reporter on hand to witness the takeoff, westward this time across America to California, rather than eastward across the Atlantic to Europe. Of course, by 1940, commercial air service had been hauling transcontinental freight, passengers, and mail for more than a decade, and doing so largely as a result of the incentive of Lindbergh's solo feat and his industrious efforts as $1 million-a-year consultant to the newly organized airlines. But it wasn't the wealthy advocate of commercial aviation who was launching his campaign that day. Nor was it the Lindbergh who had been decorated in Berlin by the Nazis, nor the Lindbergh who, in a nationwide radio broadcast, had blamed overly influential Jews for attempting to drive the country into war, nor was it even the stoical father of the infant kidnapped and killed by Bruno Hauptmann in 1932. It was rather the unknown airmail pilot who dared to do what had never been done by any aviator before him. The adored Lone Eagle, boyish and unspoiled still, despite the years of phenomenal fame. On the holiday weekend that closed out the summer of 1940, Lindbergh came nowhere near besting the record time for a coast-to-coast nonstop flight that he himself said a decade back, with an aircraft more advanced than the old Spirit of St. Louis. Nonetheless, when he arrived at Los Angeles Airport, a crowd consisting largely of aircraft workers, tens of thousands of them, employed by the big new manufacturers in and around L.A., was as overcome with enthusiasm as any ever to greet him anywhere. The Democrats called the flight a publicity gimmick, stage managed by Lindbergh's staff, when in fact the decision to fly to California had been made only hours earlier by Lindbergh alone, and not by the professionals who had been assigned by the Republican Party to steer the political novice through his first political campaign and who, like everyone else, had been expecting him to turn up in Detroit. His speech was unadorned and to the point, delivered in a high-pitched, flat, Midwestern, decidedly un-Rooseveltian American voice. His flight outfit of high boots and jodhpurs and a lightweight jumper worn over a shirt and tie was a replica of the one in which he'd crossed the Atlantic, and he spoke without removing his leather headgear or flight goggles, which were pushed up onto his forehead, exactly as Sandy had them positioned in the charcoal drawing hidden beneath his bed. "My intention in running for the presidency," he told the raucous crowd once they had stopped chanting his name, is to preserve American democracy by preventing America from taking part in another world war. Your choice is simple. It's not between Charles A. Lindbergh and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's between Lindbergh and war. That was the whole of it. 41 words, if you included the A for Augustus. After a shower and a snack and an hour's nap there at the L.A. airport, the candidate climbed back into the Spirit of St. Louis and flew to San Francisco. By nightfall, he was in Sacramento, and wherever he landed in California that day, it was as though the country hadn't known the stock market crash and the miseries of the Depression, or the triumphs of FDR for that matter, as though even the war he was there to prevent us from entering hadn't so much as crossed anyone's mind. Lindy flew down out of the sky in his famous plane, and it was 1927 all over again. It was Lindy all over again, straight-talking Lindy, who had never to look or to sound superior, who simply was superior. Fearless Lindy, at once youthful and gravely mature, the rugged individualist, a legendary American man's man, who gets the impossible done by relying solely on himself. Over the next month and a half, he proceeded to spend one full day in each of the 48 states, until in late October he made his way back to the Long Island runway from which he'd taken off on Labor Day weekend. Throughout the daylight hours, he would hop from one city, town, or village to the next, landing on highways if there was no nearby airstrip, and taking off from a stretch of pasture when he flew to talk with farmers and their families in the remotest of America's rural counties. His airfield remarks were broadcast over local and regional radio stations, and several times a week, from the state capital where he was spending the night, he broadcast a message to the nation. It was always succinct and went like this. To prevent a war in Europe is now too late, but it is not too late to prevent America from taking part in that war. FDR is misleading the nation. America will be carried to war by a president who falsely promises peace. The choice is simple. Vote for Lindbergh or vote for war. As a young pilot in aviation's early novelty days, Lindbergh, along with an older, more experienced sidekick, had entertained crowds throughout the Midwest by skydiving in a parachute or walking out parachuteless onto the plane's wing, and the Democrats were now quick to belittle his barnstorming in the Spirit of St. Louis by likening it to these stunts. At press conferences, Roosevelt no longer bothered to make a derisive quip when questioned by newsmen about the unorthodox Lindbergh campaign, but simply moved on to discuss Churchill's fear of an imminent German invasion of Britain, or to announce that he would be asking Congress to fund the first American peacetime draft, or to remind Hitler that the United States would not tolerate any interference with the transatlantic aid our merchant vessels were supplying to the British war effort. It was clear from the start that the president's campaign was to consist of remaining in the White House, where, in contrast to what Secretary Ickes labeled Lindbergh's carnival antics, he planned to address the hazards of the international situation with all the authority at his command, working round the clock if necessary. Twice during the state-by-state tour, Lindbergh was lost in bad weather, and each time several hours passed before radio contact with him was reestablished, and he was able to let the country know that all was well. But then, in October, on the very day Americans were stunned to learn that in the latest of the destructive night raids on London, the Germans had bombed St. Paul's Cathedral, a newsflash at dinner time reported that the Spirit of St. Louis had been seen to explode in the air over the Alleghenies and plummet to the earth in flames. This time, it was 6 long hours before a second flash corrected the first, with the news that it was engine trouble and not a mid-air explosion that had forced Lindbergh to make an emergency landing on treacherous terrain in the mountains of western Pennsylvania. Before the emendation was aired, however, our phone rang continuously, friends and relatives calling to speculate with our parents on the initial account of the fiery and probably fatal accident. In front of Sandy and me, our parents said nothing to indicate relief at the prospect of Lindbergh's death, though neither did they say that they hoped it wasn't so, nor were they among the jubilant when, around 11 that night, Word came through that far from having gone down in flames, the Lone Eagle had emerged safely from the undamaged plane and was waiting only for a replacement part so as to take off and resume his campaign.